But it is a tremendous truth. That's why we should expect great, enormous conflict in the book of Revelation. Because it deals with the greatest things God does. And the greatest things that God does meet with the greatest opposition of Satan. According to the book of Revelation, and according to the Bible as a whole, a mighty battle is taking place in the world tonight. While we're here in this class, a mighty battle is taking place. And it's that battle of Genesis 3:15. The battle between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. There's a verse in Revelation we'll study later. I want to introduce the subject with this verse now. It's Revelation 12:7. Revelation 12:7 says, "And there was war in heaven." And there was war in heaven. You just stop and ask the group, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when I say this word? War. War. Well, the average person will think of a war on earth. World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, the Vietnam War, or something else. War on earth. But you see, Revelation 12, verse 7, says there was war in heaven. And that war in heaven is the key to all the wars on earth. What's the main thing that caused World War I? There was war in heaven. What's the main thing that caused World War II? There's war in heaven. Someone says, no, the thing that caused it was all the wickedness of man. Yes, that was the reason on the human level. But back behind that is the fact that there was war in heaven. One of the simplest ways in which to understand this is to compare the book of Revelation with the book of Job. Often when we talk about the Old Testament counterparts to Revelation, we single out two particular books. Genesis is one. Genesis tells how everything began. And Revelation tells how everything ends, how everything is climax. So Genesis and Revelation should be studied together. Then often when people in schools are studying Revelation, they study it along with Daniel. Courses on Daniel and Revelation. And Daniel is a great Old Testament counterpart. As far as I can recall, I've never heard anybody say that Job is a great Old Testament counterpart to Revelation, but it's one of the greatest of all. Because the book of Job deals with conflict in two worlds. Often we say that the message of Job is suffering. It has to do with suffering, but I don't think that's an accurate way to express the theme of Job, suffering. It's conflict in two worlds. You see, the visible world and the invisible world. And here's Job living in that visible world. And then here's the conflict between Satan and God taking place in that invisible world. And things that are happening in Job's visible world are caused by what is taking place in that great invisible world. I remember when Dr. McQuilkin used to teach the book of Revelation, the book of Job, he laid great stress on this. The battle that's going on in that unseen spiritual world. Well, there are great dangers about our relation to that unseen spiritual world. We need to be God-centered and not Satan-centered as we deal with that unseen spiritual world. But Job is just a marvelous introduction to Revelation, because Revelation tells us what's going on in that unseen world. There was war in heaven. There was war in heaven. And the war's on earth. And all the difficulties and all the things on earth that are going on that seem so terrible to us are the outgrowth of the fact that there's that war in heaven. Let me mention two ways in which the book of Revelation is related to the book of Job. The first is that Revelation is an enlarged edition of Job. Revelation is an enlarged edition of Job. If you're teaching the book of Revelation sometime, you may say, well, I'd like for people to get a simple introduction to the book I'm teaching from the New Testament. Well, Job is simpler, the way it sounds, than is the book of Revelation. Particularly is that true of the first two chapters, the prose introduction, and the last chapter, the prose conclusion of Job. And then you just come to Job, and you have the enlarged edition of Job in the book of Revelation. Job has to do primarily with the individual relation to that battle in the unseen world. What happens to Job? My, think of it, he lost 10 children in one cyclone. You know, if a person loses one child, my, what a tremendous trial and tragedy that seems to be, and it is, from the human point of view. But Job lost all 10 children in one blow. And what caused that? Well, you see, you have that battle. Satan can't do anything without God's permission. And Satan gets permission, and he sends that cyclone to Job's house. That doesn't mean that every time there's a cyclone, it may necessarily come directly from Satan. I think you could go beyond scripture in that, but certainly this one was related to it. There's no doubt about it. There was war in heaven. There was war in heaven. And you see, Job gives the individual aspect of this war. Then the book of Revelation gives the national and the international aspect of the war. Things that are going on in all the nations of the world. These things that are going on in all the nations of the world are related to that fact, there's war in heaven. That's the first way in which Job is related to Revelation. Revelation is an enlarged edition of the book of Job. And then the second is that Revelation is the final edition of the book of Job. Revelation is the last book in the Bible, and it brings things to their final great climax. It's the final edition of the book of Job. Job reveals the conflict in two worlds in the intermediate stages. And just as Job reveals the conflict in its intermediate stages, Revelation reveals that conflict in its final stages. If I were to ask you how many of you have never thought of relating Job to Revelation, I think some of you who studied the Bible a good deal would say that. For years I never thought of relating Job to Revelation. I just thought Genesis and Daniel are your two Old Testament counterparts to Revelation. And they certainly are. But Job is a tremendous counterpart. There was war in heaven. There was war in heaven. Anybody discouraged tonight? Don't you give up. Remember, everything in your life has an explanation in terms of the fact that there's war in heaven, in that great unseen spiritual world. Before we leave this third impression, I want to give an important caution. The important caution is, as you deal with conflict in the Christian life, be God-centered, not Satan-centered. Be Christ-centered, not Satan-centered. There's such a thing as an over-consciousness of Satan. Such a thing as over-consciousness of Satan. Martin Luther, in part of his experience, had that over-consciousness of Satan. See, he was brought up in the background of medievalism, and they really exalted Satan as a rival god, not just the little G-O-D of this world, but the capital G-O-D of this world. Medieval theology did a lot of that, made Satan really equal to God. And you remember, you heard of how real Satan was to Martin Luther on one occasion. Martin Luther threw an inkwell at the devil. He an inkwell at the well, and for years when people visited that place, I think it was Wittenberg, they saw that mark of the inkwell. You say, was that caused by his knowledge of the Lord? I think partly yes and partly no. I think part of his consciousness of Satan was the background of that medievalism, and he hadn't gotten out of it completely. You know, Martin Luther didn't even see a Bible till he's 18 years old, and some say he didn't even see a Bible till he's 22 years old. Now, the more I contemplate about that dear man of God, I do thank the Lord for him. I'm not a Lutheran myself, but believe me, I do thank the Lord for the way God used him to start the whole thing going in a new way. There's no doubt about it. But don't be overly conscious of Satan. Dr. Priest used to say, remember, everything the Bible tells us about Satan is designed to turn our eyes to Jesus. I keep coming back to that over and over. Everything the Bible tells us about Satan is designed to turn our eyes to Jesus. I'd like to give you a caution about the writings of Mrs. Jessie Penn Lewis. Miss Jessie Penn Lewis laid great stress on conflict, and she has a book entitled War on the Saints. I think she was a dear child of God and had some very good things in her writings. I do think, for one thing, she illustrates the fact that, generally speaking, when a woman is in the realm of theology, she's in a pretty dangerous realm for her. We men are in a dangerous realm, too. But the feminine mind, generally speaking, is not a theological mind in the same sense in which the masculine mind is. There are exceptions. And I know some of these godly women know the Lord a whole lot better than their husbands do. No doubt about that. But Miss Jessie Penn Lewis wrote that War on the Saints. I was in Cuba a few years before Castro took over in Cuba. And in the West Indies mission there, they had a man they called their scholar. Usually you don't think of a scholar being on the mission field. They called him Senor Hansen. He's a graduate of Pearl Bible Institute. And he was giving a series of messages on the coast-to-coast hookup in Cuba. Not coast-to-coast in the United States, but coast-to-coast in Cuba. And the series had to do with demonism. He told me an interesting thing. I thought that most people in Cuba were Catholics. He said, no, only about 5% of the people in Cuba are Catholics. And only 5% because in the Cuban War of Independence, the priests betrayed the confidences of the people and turned a lot of people against Catholicism. See, there again is God's sovereignty. And I think I can see answers to prayer in the way the Pope being received all around the country. And no bombshell has been dropped or anything like that. But God's sovereignty in defeating the cause of Roman Catholicism. I've told my classes that I'm praying a lot against this papal invasion of North America. That's what it is. The papal invasion of North America. See, he's going to Northwest Canada after he leaves Detroit. 9 places in the United States and then into Northwest Canada. And you've got that conflict going on. This is called War on the Saints by Miss Jessie Penn Lewis. And I was asking Senor Hansen, I said, now I want to ask you about the writings of Miss Jessie Penn Lewis. You're dipping into this thing of demonism. He said the reason was that 50% of the people of Cuba were given to some form of demonism. No wonder they accepted Castro when this other demon came along. And demonism, and I said, am I accurate in warning my young people about Ms. Jessie Penn Lewis' writings? He said, yes. He said, Madame Guyon, the French mystic, was a mystic in the direction of God. And there's danger in being a mystic in the direction of God. So a mystic, that comes from the word muo, means to close your eyes. A mystic is one who lays stress on the inner life. And in that sense, a true Christian is a mystic. But usually I use that word mystic of false mysticism. Close your eyes. It said, Madame Dion was a mystic in the direction of God. Mrs. Jessie Penn Lewis is a mystic in the direction of Satan. And he said, mysticism in the direction of Satan is even more dangerous than mysticism in the direction of God. True. See, there's a long way to enter into this conflict. Let me express it like this and say it's one thing to be fighting the fight of faith in the war against Satan. It's another thing to be fighting the devil all the time. You see, there's a difference in those two things. It's one thing to be fighting the fight of faith. Bible says, fight the fight of faith, lay hold on eternal life. One thing to be fighting the fight of faith in the war against Satan. Another thing to be fighting Satan. Be fighting the devil and being conscious of him all the time. We had a dear lady back in my hometown at Johnson City, Tennessee, who was always saying, oh, that's the devil. That's the devil. I remember Dr. Pace of the Sunday School Times came for a Bible conference in our church. He had a flat tire on the way. When he came, she greeted him and said, oh, that's the devil. He said, no, I don't think so. It was just too much oil in the tire. See, that was his way of saying, you can be wrongly conscious of that. But I want to tell you, folks, if you really seek that fellowship with God and go all the way with the Lord, you're going to be conscious that something's opposing you. There's no doubt about that. There was war in heaven. there was war in heaven. That's the great key. The war on earth is the outworking of the war in heaven. My first general impression of Revelation is connected with the letter B. Big contrasts. Big contrasts. One of the main ways in which we learn the truth is by contrast. You have the true thing here, and then you have the false thing over here. The true thing here, and the false thing over here. It's a great principle of pedagogy, of teaching. The great principle of homiletics, of preaching. Contrast. And the book of Revelation, more than any other book in the Bible, gives us these striking contrasts. Tonight, I'll just mention five of those many contrasts. We'll be studying other contrasts as we come to our subsequent study. The first contrast I want to mention is the contrast between God's throne and Satan's throne. It's very interesting to compare the first two uses of the word throne in the book of Revelation. The first time the word throne occurs in Revelation is in chapter 1, verse 4. In chapter 1, verse 4, God's throne is mentioned. Listen to Revelation 1:4. John, to the seven churches that are in Asia, grace to you and peace from him who is and who was and who is to come, and from the seven spirits that are before his throne. You see, you're only four verses deep into Revelation when you have your first reference to the throne, God's throne. Then in chapter 2, verse 13, we have Satan's throne. Listen to Revelation 2:13. I know where thou dwellest, even where Satan's throne is. God's throne, Satan's throne. Aren't you glad that God's throne is mentioned before Satan's throne is mentioned? Well, I tell you, I'm not afraid of Satan's throne in terms of God's throne. Often we think, well, we ought to be afraid of the devil. Ought to be afraid of the devil. You know, there's a passage in the gospel where Jesus, I can't locate it right now in my mind, who says, is it the 10th chapter? Says, fear him that is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Some think that's Satan. No, that's not Satan. That's God. See, Satan will suffer more than anybody else in hell. He'll be the most abject person in hell. And that's not fear Satan. That's fear God, who's able to destroy both soul and body in hell. But Satan's throne, I'm not afraid of it in terms of God's throne. It's a tremendous thing to realize that any moment when my eyes are fixed on Jesus, Satan's afraid of me. I don't need to be afraid of him. My eyes are fixed on Jesus. He's afraid of me. At any moment when your eyes are fixed on Jesus, Satan's afraid of you. He's afraid of you. Because it's God's throne that's controlling you completely. And you see, God's throne is mentioned before Satan's throne. Now, in Revelation, the call all the way through is, be sure you line up on the right side. That's right. Everybody lines up either with Satan's throne or with God's throne. There's no middle ground. No middle ground. It gives that clear-cut choice between the right and the wrong. The second contrast I want to mention is the contrast between the synagogue of Satan and the temple of God. Synagogue of Satan, the temple of God. Now, the synagogue of Satan here has a special bearing on the Jews who rejected Christ. But I think it goes far beyond the Jews who rejected Christ. It includes anybody who rejects Christ. Listen to Revelation 3:9. Behold, I give of the synagogue of Satan, of them that say they are Jews and they're not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet and know that I have loved thee. Now listen to Revelation 3:12, just three verses later. Revelation 3:12 says, he that overcometh, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out thence no more. What a striking contrast you have in those two verses. 3:9, the synagogue of Satan. 3:12, the temple of God. Every person belongs either to the synagogue of Satan or the temple of God. There's no middle ground. I think it's a very significant thing that the word temple, which is used all the way through the book of Revelation, is the more intimate term. One Greek term for temple is the word hieron, H-I-E-R-O-N. Here's the Greek equivalent, hieron. The other word is naos, N-A-O-S. The Greek equivalent, I think the accent is here, naos. Hieron is the less intimate term of the two. Hieron refers to the whole temple enclosure, referring to the temple, the court of the Gentiles, and everything included, the less intimate term. Naas is the word which the margin says is translated sanctuary. That's the holy part. The sanctuary was in two parts, the holy place and the holy of holies. And I think it's very significant that every time without exception, the word temple is used in the book of Revelation, it always uses the more intimate term. We're the temple of God. We're the holy place, the holy of holies of God. And you see what a contrast you have between those two things. The synagogue of Satan, the holy of holies of God. That's the choice. You see, all the way through the ascended Lord giving this to the Apostle John is just giving the invitation. He doesn't just have to pull the net at the close of the service, so to speak. But he's just giving the invitation all the way through. Line up with the holy of holies of God rather than with the synagogue of Satan. The third contrast is the contrast between the dragon and the beast on one hand and the lamb on the other hand. And you see, everybody either lines up with the dragon and the beast or he lines up with the lamb. No middle ground between the two things. The Greek word lamb is a diminutive form of the word. In the Greek, it's the word arnios. A-R-N-I-O-S. That I-O is the diminutive form of the word. It means little. And all the way through the book of Revelation, you'll find 28 times Christ is called the Lamb. And every time without exception, that same diminutive form is used. Little Lamb. Little Lamb. One of the most famous commentaries on the book of Revelation is the one that was written by Dr. Joseph Seitz, S-E-I-S-S. I have it in three volumes. It's very detailed in the book. And he translates it, pet lamb. See, Christ is the lamb. Christ is the little lamb. Christ is the pet lamb. And you see the contrast all the way through? Here's the little pet lamb on one hand, overcoming all those wild beasts on the other hand, and the dragon on the other hand. What is different between those two things? Every person either lines up with God's little pet lamb, or he lines up with the beast. You can see what an encouragement to faith this would be, because remember these folks to whom the book of Revelation was written were in great danger of being thrown to wild beasts. That's one reason you have such prominence of beasts in the book of Revelation. And we'll find a year who the real beast is behind the throne. The real beast behind the throne is somebody worse than Nero. Or somebody giving power to Nero. And these others who are involved. And my, what it would mean to them. And the idea is, well, if I accept Christ as my Savior and Lord and follow him as the Lord of my life, then I may be thrown to the wild beasts. And the idea is those who line up with the beasts probably won't be thrown to the beasts. But if you line up to the Lamb, you may be thrown to the beasts, but you have someone who rules over the beasts. My, that goes all the way through the book. That's your third contrast. It's the contrast between the dragon and the beast on one hand and the lamb, God's red pet lamb on the other hand. Some people have rendered that word lamb, lambkin. You know, the Scots use words like that. A lambkin, the little lamb. And here is God's lambkin, God's pet lamb, God's little lamb. And all the things that are accomplished by that little lamb. Then the fourth contrast is the contrast between the harlot in chapter 18 and the bride in chapter 19. The harlot in chapter 18 and the bride in chapter 19. Now the King James translates it whore. In our English, I think that is even an uglier word than the word harlot. Take either word you want there. It's the whore over against the bride. It's the harlot over against the bride. You see, every person is either a part of the whore or a part of the bride. There's no middle ground between those two things. Do you all realize the significance? I'm sure at least some have thought of it, but often we have these customs and nobody's really gone to the root of the custom. Why is it that the bride comes dressed in these white garments? You see, God is saying to people that she is a virgin. And if she comes there and she's had premarital sex, and she's lying. If a person engages in premarital sex, then she has no right to a church wedding. No right to a church wedding, because she's lying. If she comes dressed in that. That may be a point to you sometimes with these young people who are so filled with worldly ideas, and the idea is that after all you're going to be married anyway, and premarital sex would be really be accepted. It would deprive her of a wedding ceremony if she did it, because that white wedding gown is a public announcement that she is a virgin. And if she's not, she's lying when she does it. Though every person is either lined up with the whore or the harlot or with the bride. Just try to get a visual image of the harlot's face. Such a hard face. Every now and then you can pass a woman, and of course you don't have to guess wrongly, but it just looks like the face is so hard. Also true of men's faces often. They're so hard. So hard. And then just think of all the disease in that body. And what a repulsive thing that is. You see, every unsaved person lines up with the whore. Every saved person lines up with the bride that is a part of the bride. Tremendous contrast. Then the fifth contrast in the book is the contrast between the lake of fire and the river of life. The lake of fire and the river of life. Listen to Revelation 20, verses 14 and 15. Revelation 20, 14 and 15. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. And if any was not found written in the book of life, he was cast into the lake of fire. 21:8. But for the fearful, notice this list of those who go to the lake of fire, and notice the first one mentioned. First one is the fearful. Fearful. Talk about a fear complex. The complex. The fearful go to the lake of fire. Well, you say, how's that a fire? Well, one clear application is cowards. Those are fearful. They're cowards, and they won't come out and take a stand for Christ. Won't accept him as Savior. That's part of what it means. But rather than accepting fear as a complex, I have to be awfully careful on that. That is, the Bible views fear as a sin. Fear not. Fear not, fear not. And the fifth, that's the first group mentioned, going to the lake of fire. And then at the end, he says, and all lives, little white lies, big black lies, all lives go to the lake of fire. It's significant to use the word all only for lives. It applies to all the others. But to use it only for lives, to make that stand out in a special way. All right, here's the lake of fire. And then in Revelation 22:1, he showed me a river of water of life, bright as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb. The river of life. River of life. See, everybody's either on his way to the lake or the river. One the other. The lake of fire and the river of the water of life. In a group this size. I wonder how many here are absolutely sure beyond a doubt that you're saved. Oh, when I was a young Christian, somebody faced me with this. Drive a stake a mile deep in the ground that you know you're saved. You know you're saved. It's either the lake or the river. The lake of fire or the river of the water of life. Let's bow our heads together.